Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The Defense Department has a new office, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Cyber Policy, and it's got a wide portfolio. Perhaps the toughest are development and retention of the workforce. The DoD is trying to cut its cyber workforce vacancy rate by 25% next year. For how DoD is reimagining that cyber workforce under so-called 8140 policy, Federal News Network's Jason Miller spoke with the branch chief for cyber workforce development under the DoD CIO office, Matthew Eisner.
It's kind of the next evolution from the 8570 policy series. 8570 focused mostly on the information assurance workforce. This expands the scope a little bit underneath what cyber is. When we talk cyber in the department, we talk cyber security, IT, cyber operations, AI, data, software engineering. It's a much bigger audience than what 8570 covers. So that was kind of the beginning stages, but also with the amount of individuals that we are kind of bringing into the fold, we wanted to expand the scope, the aperture, to be able to qualify the workforce. We want to make sure that they're ultimately being capable of doing the job that we're aligning them to do. We want to give some information to the gaining organizations across the board. So 8140 really focuses on qualifying the individuals in the environment that we're bringing them in to ultimately be able to do.
And the reason why the policy update is important and necessary is because the way cyber has changed, expanded to what it means, right? Years ago, it was, you're just worried about the data center and network. Now cyber falls into so many different areas. Is that part of the reason why the 8140 policy, one, it took so long, but two, is such an important update?
Cyber, as we have learned over the last decade, touches everything. Technology touches everything. A lot of what we're doing with the DCWF, the Defense Workforce Cyber Workforce Framework, and 8140 is touching a bigger talent pool. The individuals coming up from this environment, I use the tree analogy, has a lot of STEM background. They're the trunk. They're bringing up their knowledge base, and then they specialize into various fields: cyber, cybersecurity, IT, AI, data. And we need to be able to kind of work as a department and with all of the collaboration across the department and going in the same direction. So we don't need to be fighting over the same talent. We need to be working together to kind of codify what that looks like.
And you all have done that over the last year, codified that talent. I think you mentioned something to the effect of 225,000 people now fall under this idea of cybersecurity. Talk a little about what's happened with the 8140 policy since it got signed out over the last year. What some of those implementation actions that happened, and then we'll talk about what will happen in 2024 and beyond.
Yeah, so when we talk about the actual 8140, we got signed in February. We've been working with all of our stakeholders to ultimately start preparing them for what we mean by implementing. So what are we going to be doing with actually looking and making sure that their individuals are qualified. We're going to start tracking them from a coding perspective, looking at their billets to kind of see how they align to the quals matrix, what we align from a baseline foundations. We look at three ways that these individuals can ultimately be qualified. You have certifications, you have training, you have education. That's opening the aperture. When I mentioned 8570 before, it was just solely based on certifications. This one is opening that area. We have a lot more throughput going through. So we are trying to kind of think outside the box for qualifying those workforce. So we want to be able to kind of look at that area and start really kind of honing in and start working with our stakeholders to make sure that they're implementing that and understanding where they need to go, making sure all of their billets are coded, making sure that they have identified all their workforce and start working on making sure they're qualified for those areas when we actually start kind of monitoring and tracking their our individuals.
If I could just jump in real quick, because one of the reasons why this is important is I think there's a realization that has happened over the last, again, 5-7 years, that just because you don't have a cybersecurity education per se, it doesn't mean you're not going to be good or qualified to do cybersecurity or you're not doing cybersecurity. Is that the reason why you kind of expanded it to say it's education, it's training, it's certifications?
Yeah, that's one of the big fact finding that we had over the last decade is the traditional pathways was go 4-year degrees, education. In cyber, the talent out there has different traditional pathways. They have They get certifications. They get education. They get training in other ways. A lot of our military individuals come up and don't have any of that. So there's a lot of ways that we need to be able to kind of attract the right talent coming in. We need to think outside the box. We need to be able to attract the individuals that just love building networks, that sit down in their mom's basement and sit there and start codifying a lot of these things, because that's the true cyber person in the environment. There, and so we need to be able to kind of identify ways that we can get them into our jobs and bring that, you know, expert talent into that.
Let's go back to some of those implementation of the 8140. You mentioned, for instance, make sure people are coded while the billets are coded. That's something you're looking at, I imagine. There's some deadlines around that coming up. Maybe just walk me through a little bit of the deadlines, because I think you went through, there's a lot of different numbers, and some are doing 25, and but 26, but then again in 27. So walk me through some of the dates people should keep in mind.
Some of it's a little confusing, and one of the ways that we are going to be able to kind of tracking mechanisms is we've worked 2 years to get them in the queue, make sure they're be able to report in their manpower and personnel systems. Make sure that they get us those informations. But the first staple, the first kind of mark on the date timeline is February 2025. We have seven elements inside of the DCWF. The first one that we're going to start kind of tracking is the cybersecurity element. So any of the billets that are coded against the cybersecurity work roles will ultimately be reporting on 8140 and their qualifications. And then we'll start working through that to find kind of the lessons learned, how the tracking is going, how that, you know, kind of aligns. And then the rest of the workforce ultimately in any of the elements will start tracking in February 2026. So those are the kind of the main two dates.
The other piece of this, I think, is the curriculum, the training piece. You have to understand, okay, what do we need? What do people need to meet the certain goals under 8140? Talk a little bit about the work you're doing to look at both certifications, but training and the like.
One of the big wonderful ways to use the framework, the DCWF, is it kind of codifies exactly what those capabilities are. What are the requirements? What are the knowledge and skills that our people need to be able to do on a day-to-day operation? So what we are able to leverage that is then go talk to our providers, so our certification providers, our training providers, our academic partners, and start communicating that. What do we want our workforce to look like in the next 5 to 10 years? And use this as kind of the blueprint and say, this is the knowledge and skills that we ultimately want to kind of incorporate. So then we go through the mechanism to kind of look at certifications and start validating the content that's in there, communicating with them. It's all about collaboration. It's one of these things, we're in it together. They're there. We're one of the customers for those areas. The academic partners are there because they are the ones training the future, the individuals coming into the next, you know, the department in the next 10 years. So we need to be able to be at the forefront to be able to communicate what those requirements ultimately look like.
At the same time, I know that you mentioned that there's some folks in the academic world already looking at, okay, what's coming up, like hypersonics or quantum? How are they starting to train the next generation of workers? Are those the conversations you're having today with academics, asking them, what do we need to make sure our sailors, seamen, soldiers, service members need to know?
Yeah, so on kind of a quarterly basis, we meet with a lot of our academic partners. We have one partnership with the CAEs, Centers of Academic Excellence, about 450 different universities. NDU runs a cyber consortium where they bring a lot of think tank individuals to it. So those are the forums that we kind of bring those things, where we have the current workforce with the DCWF. We have 72 work roles inside of that. And we identify what are the work roles of critical need, what do we want our workforce to look like. But then we also get into the areas of what is the emerging technology, what are the areas of the future that ultimately might start creeping into the frameworks, into the areas of the workforce. Quantum obviously is, hypersonic is one of the areas. So we start kind of trying to game plan for the you know, next couple decades of where we're going to go in technology.
Matthew Eisnor, Branch Chief for Cyber Workforce Development in the Office of the DoD Chief Information Officer, speaking with Federal News Network's Jason Miller. Check out Jason's story at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Kolmstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way. And I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And work alongside you. Your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.